It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Millions of workers first experienced remote work during the pandemic, and today, as many as 40% of workers nationally say they do at least some of their work from home. Gabby Vinnick explores the work-from-home economy.
Are you a good girl? Yes, you are. You're a good girl, Bee.
On a sunny Friday afternoon, Laura Isaacson's dog, Bee, wants to play. After a few pets for her chocolate lab, Isaacson sits back at her computer at the kitchen table. She's surrounded by bookshelves, and she has light shining through the windows of her home in Mount Horeb. It's a different experience than her time working as a dietitian for the last 20 years. She would often drive to and from the hospital in the dark. Her commute took roughly 30 minutes to Dodgeville. Now, Isaacson works from home as a diabetes care and education specialist for a San Francisco-based company. She's one of more than 400,000 remote workers in Wisconsin.
I am so much happier right now. I don't think I even realized before how stressed out I was. Trying to balance being a mom and working full-time outside of the house.
Isaacson is one of millions of people who first worked remotely during the pandemic. Today, as many as 40% of workers nationally say they do at least some of their work from home. There are signs that some plan to return to the office. In April, a Morning Consult poll found nearly half of U.S. employees prefer working in person. And a Pew Research survey in March found that remote workers tend to say it hurts their opportunities to be mentored. But Isaacson says she has no immediate plans to return to the office, and working from home has given her more flexibility.
That's something I think a lot of moms struggle with. You feel really guilty trying to find that balance. And for me, the flexible schedule, not having a start time or an end time, and just being able to work when it works for me and works for my family, huge difference.
In Mineral Point, Rachel Bergstrom speaks with a client on Zoom from a small room in her farmhouse.
Yeah, Friday afternoons are really flexible for me after 2, so.
She's an education consultant for a Texas-based company. Not long ago, this meeting would have been impossible. She says their Wi-Fi would not have been stable enough to run. But in recent years, millions of federal and state dollars have gone to expanding broadband access in Wisconsin. It now reaches more than 90% of state residents. That infrastructure has helped Bergstrom connect with colleagues all across the country. For her, remote work meant an end to years of leaving her home at 5 a.m. She had to wake up early to catch a ride on the state van pool to her job with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. In all, she spent about 3 hours on the road.
I don't know that I coped with the commute. I think it took a bigger toll on me than I realized now that I have more time to think.
Jose Maria Barrero is a finance professor and co-founder of the nationally recognized Work From Home Research Project. He says a relatively low-cost state like Wisconsin could be a winner in the work-from-home economy.
I think Wisconsin is interesting in that it is a state that has both large urban areas and a lot of rural areas. And so I think it has an opportunity to perhaps decongest the congested parts of the state.
Barrero says if rural areas have greater access to high-income workers, that could be a boon for local economies. But more work from home also means less foot traffic to urban downtowns, which creates its own challenges. Back in Mineral Point, Bergstrom says she hopes remote work possibilities benefit small towns like hers.
Maybe kids will stay in their small towns more because they can find a job programming, or they can find a job in an industry that's really booming, even if there's not a huge company here that does that.
Remote work is already shaping policy in new ways for Wisconsin, and Bergstrom is one of thousands who has no plans to get back to the office. Gabby Vinnick, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine ways to curb teen substance use as vaping products and cannabis edibles become more accessible. What drug and vaping prevention strategies are underway in Wisconsin? Call in with your question. Share thoughts on teen substance use at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Megan Tim is SSM Health Regional Director of Community Health. Megan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So earlier this spring, the Monroe County Sheriff's Office reported more teens and children as young as 8 in possession of marijuana and vaping devices. And an 18-year-old was arrested for supplying drugs to students. Are you finding more teens and younger children with these drugs?
Unfortunately, I have to say yes. I've been privileged to be able to be in some of our local middle schools across southern Wisconsin, speaking with middle school students about vaping nicotine as well as marijuana. And I've found that there are sixth graders raising their hand when asking them if they have ever tried a vape device, if they've ever experimented or felt the pressure to utilize these products. And I'm always a little shocked when I see, you know, an 11-year-old raise their hand saying, but it's not the first time. And so I do, the news was not necessarily shocking to me working with youth in the middle schools, knowing that there's an increased trend of our younger and younger students using these products.
What's behind that? What is behind this increased accessibility of electronic cigarette use or vaping among these young children?
Yeah, that's the question, right? So when, again, I like to go to the source. I think sometimes as adults, when we're in this space, we make a lot of assumptions about our youth and the why they are using these products. And I think a lot of times we go back into our history and think, what happened? What were we pressured to do when we were, you know, in middle school? And so it feels like we've talked a lot about the peer pressure, about the social norm around vaping. And though there is an aspect to that, when I speak to students, specifically students that are using THC in their vape devices, it's not necessarily a peer pressure moment. It is more of a coping device. And that's honestly a little bit more terrifying to me, that our middle schoolers are feeling that they need a method of coping for different mental health issues, whether that be anxiety, depression, home life, ACEs scores, right? That's something I talked to some of the students about. And I'm happy to speak more about that this morning. But you know, what have you experienced in your life that you are looking for a coping device while you're in the middle school when you are at that age? And when we have older siblings perhaps getting access to them or parents utilizing them, they're often found on counters amongst other spaces. They're not often disposed of well, and that increases access. We also have, you can probably drive through any town in Wisconsin and see a new vape shop that's gone up in the last several years or few years even. And just that increase of exposing our youth to access to those things. You can have laws all day that say 21 and up, or, you know, eliminating, clearly not allowing middle schoolers to get access to a vape device, but we know that the access is just tremendous, and there's not a lot of measures on that right now. So our students are having a lot of free access to these things.
I want to go further into ACEs, but, you know, adverse childhood experiences and the mental health component here. But can vaping nicotine or vaping cannabis, can it worsen depression and anxiety or situations, or interfere with socializing at school and the emotional experiences?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. When looking at some recent research, it's been noted that those that vape nicotine first, right, have three and a half times more likely to use cannabis if vaping nicotine. And so often they'll use their vape devices to utilize both products then. So 3.5 times more likely. And I think it's a perception issue. So our youth have a perception that THC and marijuana are more natural of products. And so when we use that term natural, just like with our food, right, our students are assuming that it's okay. And the perception is that it's not a harmful product. We have seen that there is an increase of inflammation in the pulmonary system for those that are smoking THC. But the perception of our youth is that it increases their focus and it reduces anxiety, which allows them to communicate better in school. Now, I'm not a teacher, but I have to assume some of our teachers probably would not agree with that. But there is this perception of natural products going into their body and that it's actually reducing their stress. Now, we know with nicotine products that it actually increases stress on the body. It's not just something that causes addiction anymore. We know that it causes harmful physical attributes to our body as well. So I think it's this idea that it's a healthier product, and therefore students feel like it's reasonable to try it out and see if it does in fact support their anxiety concerns or helps them focus better at school.
You teach Janesville students about the short-term and the long-term effects of using THC, the main psychoactive compound in marijuana, as well as in nicotine products, the effects of those. What are those risks for youth as they see, like, cannabis edibles and, you know, things with THC in so many places in the consumer marketplace?
Yeah, in Wisconsin, you know, we don't have legalization of things. So I often tell students, you don't actually know what's in these products because they're not being regulated. And so that's it. That's step one, right? It's not, I always start my conversations with youth on a level of respect, saying, it's not my body, it's yours. You have to make the choice, but you have to make an educated choice. So let's talk about that. And so I think that it's allowing students to explore the research themselves to understand where we're at. And up until last year, which was very exciting, but in 2022, July of last year, a new act was passed, the Research Expansion Act, which was passed by bipartisan legislators to support the research of marijuana in THC. You know, when it's federally, it's not legal. It's really hard to understand the impacts of it, especially with youth. Of course, our vulnerable population. We don't allow studies in that space, right? And so, that act has helped get some energy around the need for more research to be done on marijuana and the impact of the body in our youth. So you're right. I have the privilege of being with middle schoolers in the Janesville area who have been very open in telling about their experiences and their ability to access. And, you know, I ask how many of you walk to school and walk past a vape shop or a store that sells these devices, and 50% of the students will raise their hand. And so we don't necessarily have ordinances and things in place that eliminate the amount of vape shops close to a youth building, for example, or in proximity to a youth building to help reduce that exposure. As we know, the more advertising and exposure to these products, the more likely students are to try them on for size.
So is vaping then a gateway into further substance use?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And I hadn't necessarily thought about it like that. You know, when I think about gateway drugs, I'm 36. I think about my high school days in prevention of drug use. And when the research says 3.5 times more likely to use cannabis, I kind of keep to that language rather than gateway. I don't think that every single student that is trying out a vape is going to move to harder, more illicit drugs necessarily in their future. But I do think it opens up the door when you can use the same device to utilize both things. And so when you can interchange using THC in your vape device as well as nicotine, it creates an easiness almost for students to be able to utilize those. And again, I often speak to students about brain development and what are those choices really meaning? Is it a small choice or a big choice to make to choose to try these products? It might feel like a small choice in the moment, but in reality, when you're making this decision, it has lifelong impacts on the addiction piece. So in regards to if I think it's a gateway, I think it opens up the door for potential further use of cannabis or experimentation.
Megan Tim with us, Regional Director of Community Health at SSM Health, breaking down prevention and intervention strategies amid the availability of vape pens. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts about substance use in young people. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We dig deeper into adolescent substance use and intervention strategies as nicotine vaping is one of the top forms of substance use among teens, and researchers say it could be a gateway to other dangerous habits. Call in with questions and thoughts at any point about teen drug use, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Megan Tim is here, SSM Health Regional Director of Community Health. Let's take a call now. Cassie is with us in St. Francis. Cassie, hi, go ahead.
Hi, I just had to comment that when I was in middle school and high school, we didn't use vape pens or like pipes or anything. We used like apples and soda cans. And to me, it's not about what's available. You're just going to find it. It's about what the kid is lacking, right? Like we were lacking the support we needed. We were lacking strong parental figures who are willing to listen to us and other resources like that for the youth. And so to me, it's more like if the kid is missing out something, they're going to try to fill it in any way they can, and they're going to use whatever they can. So like vapes aren't like the, you know, the end all be all. They're going to do it regardless is my comment.
Cassie, thank you. Megan, go ahead.
Cassie, I so appreciate your comment, and I could not agree more with what you just said. It is really filling that void, and you're right. I was reflecting briefly as well about what are those things that you do when, as an adult, when you reflect back, and agreed, right? You're going to find a mechanism to cope or to fill the void that you're finding, and so I think you're spot on, and what a beautiful segment into resources for our youth. If we're looking at what's available for our youth, if you are, you know, some students are into athletics or into the extracurriculars and can fill that void with and social time. And others don't necessarily have that support, whether that be at home or with friends, or perhaps they've moved to several schools and they haven't built that network of support. And so we need to be better about making sure that no kid is left behind, honestly. And that's a difficult task when teachers are asked to be social workers and all the other things upon being a teacher. And so I think you're spot on, Cassie. We need more support and identification of when those students have those gaps so we can fill it with something more productive and more positive.
From your viewpoint, are there enough substance use counselors in our schools to educate students about the problems with drugs and alcohol, and then also identify and support the kids with substance use disorders?
Yeah, I think that there's always going to be a more of a need for that support. And what I found coming from a healthcare system into the schools, what I've heard from both staff and honestly students who are more open to speaking to me about things than they are teachers. And that's not to the fault of school staff, right? There's just a trust gap there, perhaps, with wanting to share all of your intimate details on why you're using a substance as a youth. But coming out from the outside and being from a separate entity and not being seen as an authority figure to these youth, they open up and they do want to share. They do want to talk about it, and they want to understand it more, and they want to be a part of the solution. And so asking more substance use staff at schools to get involved, I'm not sure we would actually get down to students opening up with actual staff at the school. It really takes the whole community to better support these students and not just the schools and school districts.
Talking about youth possessing nicotine products, vape products, cannabis edibles, Megan Tim with us, the SSM Health Regional Director of Community Health. Let's take a call. Sean now in Eau Claire. Sean, hi.
Hello there. I'm Sean. I'm a hemp grower, actually, in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And one of the big concerns for me is hemp and cannabis really is a medicine. It can have, both can offer many benefits to people under the right conditions. What is scary, however, is the D9s, the HHCs, all these other cannabinoids that they're enhancing products with and adding to these vapes that can be, people can get easily in an unregulated market. When I was a teenager, the gateway for me was alcohol and cigarettes. The truth of the matter is cannabis has kept me and many, many other people from harder drugs. And the black market really doesn't care if they sell drugs to your children, whereas a regulated market where people could lose their businesses, lose their license, and be out in the open where they can directly face charges for distributing to minors is it's just preventative to the safety of our children to have the black markets. If we bring all this out into the forefront, we're more likely to keep our children safe.
Sean, thank you. I want to be able to get Megan to respond here about, you know, how easily someone, a youth, can get into an unregulated market space here with these products.
Yeah, Sean, thank you for that. I agree in the sense that students, the regulations are helpful, right? And in helping provide more guidance and structure around these things. And you're right. Vape companies, you know, nicotine and vape companies at this point have not discriminated against advertising to our youth. In fact, they were just charged $435 million for that. So you're right. They don't necessarily care if your youth are getting access. And in fact, they're actually gaining quite the benefit from it. And so I agree. I think having some level of regulation and the access piece is you're right. When they can get, you know, someone locally who's making things in their basement, for example, that's easier to get access to because there's no one is monitoring that situation, as opposed to in the market where folks are fearful of losing a license, like you mentioned, or abiding by the rules of the process of growing and providing and distributing. I think, unfortunately, as Kathy mentioned earlier, students will get access to things that they want, and they'll find a way to get it.
Well, Megan, thank you so much for joining us and shining a light on your work as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Megan Tim is Regional Director of Community Health at SSM Health. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.